Hello, and welcome to the Bridge to Change podcast, hosted by Jeff Nash. My name is Catherine Paulson, CMO of Bridgemark Strategies. And today, Jeff and Scott are continuing their conversation as part two of the series on key legal considerations regarding advisor transition issues. Jeff?
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for the introduction. And Scott, thanks again for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeff. Happy to be here.
Thanks. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about protocol rules and things advisors should be looking out for, making sure they are paying attention to the rules of protocol when switching firms from protocol broker dealers to protocol broker dealers. Another important topic that we hear from advisors that creates a lot of confusion among advisors is non-solicit agreements. And so I was hoping we could spend maybe some time today to talk about what advisors who may have non-solicit agreements with a firm that they've joined, are they able to leave the firm and take clients with them? How are they able to do that, right? What are some of the challenges that advisors may face when they have signed a non-solicit agreement and then are attempting to switch broker-dealers or join another firm?
Sure. Well, as we talked about in our first episode, Jeff, the protocol for broker recruiting, briefly, if you are moving from one protocol firm to another, an advisor is exempted from any non-solicit that they have in their agreement with their current firm when they leave. That's the whole point of the protocol. But in a non-protocol move, the analysis of a non-solicit becomes much more important. And has to be dealt with considerably more carefully to make sure that the advisor is handling themselves properly. And, you know, I do about 300 advisor transition engagements a year and probably move, 500 or so advisors every year. And I've seen every variety of non-solicit clause that you can imagine out there. And no two clauses are created equal. Some of them are very, very stringent, and some of them are quite lax, and you could drive a truck through them. But, you know, those gaps wouldn't be readily apparent to someone who is not a lawyer.
So if you have signed a non-solicit agreement, are you stuck? Can you talk to your clients?
Well, you can talk to them unless there's a clause in there that bars you from actually contacting the clients. And then there are a couple of firms out there that have a provision in there, but usually the language is many firms use what I call the Edward Jones formulation, which says that you cannot solicit your clients after you leave. And then the solicitation means contacting somebody for the purpose of inviting, encouraging, or, you know, requesting that they move their accounts. So it doesn't mean that the advisor can't contact their client. It means that they can't contact their client for the purpose of trying to get that business. So a common misconception is that a non-solicit creates a complete information blackout between advisor and client after departure, and that's just simply not the case in most instances.
Now, I've also been under the impression that states, right, and I certainly don't want you speaking on all 50 states today. We're not going to have time to go through state by state, you know, and that's why somebody should hire an attorney to help them with their individual state. But there are state ramifications to that, depending on where someone may live as well. Are there not?
Well, the state law matters in a couple of different ways, Jeff. First of all, in most, but not all states, in most states, the transmission of a bare bones, plain Jane tombstone letter, the courts have found does not constitute an act of quote unquote solicitation, because you're not actually urging the client to take any affirmative course of action. You're just notifying them of where you are and where your new firm is, and they can reach out if they want to. But the other way that state law can affect things, and this is perhaps a topic for another podcast, is in with regards to what rights the advisor has to retaining customer information when they leave, because different states have different levels of stringency with regards to the protections they give their residents to their confidential personal and financial data.
Yeah, that's always the tough thing is that I've heard from advisors in situations is how do I actually, you know, the firm owns the client names and lists. Can I even contact them? You know, can I use social media? How do I actually go about and reaching out to those clients? Have you had any scenarios that are, as you say, kind of largely accepted throughout, you know, like that tombstone that with advisors that certain things they can do, you know, or is it really a situation by state and by firm that they're coming from?
Well, it's really, Jeff, driven more by the contract. Certainly in all instances, an advisor can update their status profile on LinkedIn and can update their status on Facebook because you're not affirmatively contacting anybody. You're just notifying the world that you have a new job. And that is not a solicitation because you're not engaging in directed communication focused on a particular individual or client. And should the client happen to see the update, if you're connected, let's say on LinkedIn, and the client sees the update, well, that's not a solicitation because it showed up in their newsfeed as a result of the LinkedIn algorithm. And then it's up to the client to then, you know, reach out to the advisor and say, hey, I saw you took a new job. What's going on, right? But as opposed to using the in-mail function on LinkedIn or using Messenger on Facebook, where you're engaged in directed communication to particular clients, which would be problematic.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you had opportunities to kind of follow up with advisors that you've worked with who've had restrictive covenants, you know, and maybe even some of the most restrictions to understand what kind of success they have had in actually honoring their contracts, not violating them, not being sued, and still retaining majorities of their business? Have you had any kind of experiences of that? Any statistics that you'd be able to even share with the group of what you might have seen?
Well, sure, Jeff. You know, I often say that I'm the midwife, but I'm not the pediatrician, right? I get advisors out into their new firm, and what happens afterwards, I don't have a lot of insight into, although what I can say is, you know, if I'm doing about 300 advisor transitions a year, I would say on average every year, I have about a 1.5 to 2% litigation rate. So I might get, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a year where an advisor changes firms and their prior firm runs to court to try to get a restraining order. It doesn't mean that they actually can succeed, but they at least run to court to try to slow the advisor down. So the vast, vast majority of advisors whom I counsel are able to move cleanly and don't get into litigation. And that's in part because of the advice that I provide that doesn't really give the former firm any excuse to sue because the advisor has crossed their T's and dotted their I's in the way they've handled their affairs when they move.
Yeah, and that really is the most important thing. I mean, I think that's clearly a commercial in a good way, right? For not just, you know, what could be your firm's services, but for seeking the right attorney in general anyway. Right? I was you know, kind of jesting with a friend recently how they were talking to an advisor and the advisor hired their friend who was a real estate attorney. And guess what? The advisor didn't have that same success. That, you know, it really is important to get the right firm, the right attorney with the right experience. You know, it's like a tool, right? You don't use a hammer if you need a screwdriver, right? You use a screwdriver if you need a screwdriver. And I think there's an important lesson in there. You know, have you picked up clients that have started off with the kind of their friend as an attorney who may be the wrong attorney? Have you seen a lot of situations like that and been able to kind of help that advisor out from those situations?
Yeah, Jeff, unfortunately, that happens to me on a regular basis where advisors start off with a lawyer who might be very good at what they do, whether they're a general practitioner or more often than not, what I wind up picking up are a lot of advisors who started off with a labor lawyer, labor and employment lawyer, who doesn't know the first thing about the industry. They might know all about sexual harassment cases or racial discrimination or age discrimination, but don't know what AUM or GDC or trailing 12 mean. And they get poor advice. And 6 months down the road, they realize that their lawyer is being outgunned by their former firm's law firm, you know, the law firm that they retained, and wind up, you know, getting referred over to me by a friend of a friend to take over their cases. And that happens to me a couple, three times a year. So whether an advisor uses me or somebody like me, they really want to get an attorney who understands the retail financial services industry. And in any given city, there are usually at least a couple of lawyers who know this business and can properly counsel the client.
Yeah, that's some really important stuff. You know, and I know we're spending a lot of time talking about non-solicits and legal guidance. You know, the other thing that comes up frequently in non-solicit agreements are non-compete language, such as you will not work within a mile's radius of the office. I've always been skeptical of that, you know, where I heard anecdotally that a lot of states won't enforce that. Is there anything you can speak to as it relates to what a non-compete and the implications of non-competes?
Sure. Well, non-competes are enforceable, but they have to be reasonable. And what is considered reasonable is judged both by the geographic scope, how wide is the blackout area, and the length of time that it is in effect for. And every state has their own body of court precedent, you know, that spells out what that court can, what that state considers to be a reasonable non-compete. And firms that try to be overbroad run the risk of either having the non-compete whittled down by a court to a reasonable length, or in some states, they just, the courts will say, if you have an unreasonable non-compete in your contract, we're just going to throw it out altogether. But even there, Jeff, there are almost always workarounds. And I'll give you a perfect example. I represented years ago a team of advisors in Philadelphia who had a non-compete that prevented them from working in the state of Pennsylvania within 50 miles of the office. And so what did they do? I had them rent space in a Regis office across the river in Camden, New Jersey. The baseball's throw away from the Liberty Bell. Completely appropriate because it was not in the state of Pennsylvania. So a good lawyer can usually develop some sort of a workaround to a non-compete unless it's extraordinarily well-written.
Yeah, that's really important stuff. I learned something, right? Because I always was kind of under that impression non-competes were not all that enforceable. So I've learned that they really are enforceable as well. But you just have to be, again, for advisors potentially looking to sign on with a new firm, if they're looking at that stuff, you know, again, have an attorney review it in advance. And if you've already got one and you're looking to leave your firm, then, you know, certainly speak to an attorney that may be able to help you. Ultimately, doesn't this just translate into dollars and cents, right? Isn't this where protocol was originally created, where firms will just help buy you out of an agreement if it becomes too restrictive?
Well, it's often the case that when an advisor is changing from one firm to another, they'll be getting a transition package from the new firm. And sometimes those dollars are used in part to reach a financial settlement with the former firm. But ideally, the advisor will hire a lawyer who knows this area and can fashion a course of conduct for the advisor, a customized transition plan, so that it doesn't really give the old firm any excuse to sue them, and they are able to keep the money for themselves and for practice development rather than having to use it to pay off their old firm. But it does happen from time to time that occurs. But the goal is to avoid that happening.
Yeah, what's the old expression? An ounce of prevention, right?
Absolutely, Jeff. I can't tell you the number of clients I've picked up who have basically said to me, "Oh, I wish I'd met you 6 months ago."
Yeah, and I've seen it. I've seen advisors who've worked with attorneys, and the attorneys give them recommendations, and they just say, "Yeah, I don't really want to do that." Not so explicitly to the attorney, they just don't do it, right? They don't follow the recommendations, and of course, they end up in usually a different place.
Well, so often the case, and then, you know, it's no different than clients who don't take an advisor's advice, and then they're crying into their beer when they don't have a retirement fund.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Scott, I really appreciate your time today in this discussion around non-solicits and non-competes. It's been really beneficial. You know, I know our listeners will really get a lot out of this as well. Thanks again for your time.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Thanks. You as well.